Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And with Scott, as always, I'm Tom Castura.
And in this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 2nd, 2026. All right, Tom, what do you got for us today?
All right, starting today, I have an article from VolnCheck. It's titled Metro for Shell, Exploitation of React Native's Metro Server in the Wild. So just kind of a general summary of what we're looking at here. VolnCheck researchers observe real-world exploitation of an item called or dubbed Metro for Shell, which is CVE-2025-11953, which is a remote code execution flaw in the Metro development server, often used with the React Native tool. The activity was captured through VolnCheck's Canary sensors back in December of last year, with continuing use into the beginning of this year. All of this has been happening before there's been any real public awareness of this. Despite kind of that low public discussion and the low score for the vulnerability at the time, attackers have actively exploited and exposed Metro servers that are facing the internet, really emphasizing that real world exploitation. Pretty much always precedes the broad reporting. This case highlights the risk posed by development focused tooling that's exposed on public interfaces. Software designed for development testing and can become a viable production attack surface when reachable. So these are things that we're continuing to see, and you know, this kind of developer-focused attack surface, the targeting, and so on, or continuing on all the way from last year, and all of the shai-halud npm package type stuff, the PyPI compromises. You know, there's a lot of effort being targeted at developers, so it's continuing. So, as part of what happened here, so some context: Metro is a JavaScript bundler and development server that's used in React Native projects. Its default config can bind to all surfaces or all interfaces and expose an slash open URL endpoint that accepts unauthenticated post requests that are capable of executing operating system commands. So exploit traffic was first recorded on December 21st of 2025 with repeated deliveries of consistent payloads into January 2026, really indicating that ongoing operational use. Attackers leveraged the slash open URL endpoint to issue a malicious post that spawned a base64 encoded PowerShell loader via command line, which was decoded and executed on the target. So some bullets on the payload behavior. So things that we've seen this thing do, not necessarily novel, but it disables Microsoft Defender using exclusions for the areas that it's targeting, current and temp directories. It opens up a raw TCP connection to the remote infrastructure. It sent protocol data to a remote host, so it would do a get slash Windows command to pull some of that information. Downloads additional payloads to the disk. Once those payloads are there, the downloaded binary with a large argument string really suggests additional automated behavior that's kind of protected behind the mass amount of obfuscation that's happening. Those patterns were consistent across the multiple observed attacks. So the infrastructure hosting also served a corresponding Linux payload. So that kind of gives that indication that it has cross-platform intent or capabilities. The UPX packing and anti-analysis. So downloaded binaries were UPX packed and contained basic anti-analysis logic to kind of really slow down that static inspection once it was unpacked, kind of showing some level of sophistication, really focused on evasion. So there were some basic things that I pulled from this one, Scott. Again, none of it's really necessarily novel, but it does show that continuous pattern kind of focused at developers and the things they're targeting, tool sets that they are using. So some of the hunt considerations, there's some easy ones here. You know, obviously PowerShell encoded command is a constant and very easy hunt to go after. Modifying Windows Defender settings. So you're looking at things like those add MP preference commands with an exclusion path as one example. We also seen, or you could track, kind of unusual post requests that are going out to those slash open URL you know, usually contain some level of abnormal payloads or things that could correlate downstream to those PowerShell and code of command executions. And then just one other one that I kind of noted, there's a bunch here, but I'm not going to go through every one of them. One that I noted that I thought was interesting is potentially if you had telemetry and the capability, looking to do some correlation to where you can identify that that get/Windows request that occurs, followed pretty immediately by a write to that temp directory, as I mentioned. So just some basic kind of correlation hunt there. But yeah, all in all, this, you know, really brought this to the table, Scott, because this is very interesting to me. I think we talked about it in our live show last week. We fully expect the, you know, the kind of supply chain slash developer targeting things to happen, especially around like the JavaScript bundlers and Java runtime, the NPM node stuff. All of those things are going to likely continue throughout the year because they've been very successful. So yeah, wanted to bring this one up. What do you think, Scott?
No, I thought it was a very simple attack, and I like how, you know, one of the reasons why they're bringing it up is I guess they have like the honeypot or canary type infrastructure, and they just kind of saw this same attack carry on for a while consistently across their sensors and things. So it shows that someone's actively, like, you know, trying to find these types of endpoints and, you know, running this thing to compromise stuff. So it kind of falls in line with some of that typical like scan, find, and exploit behavior you see a lot with botnets. But, you know, some of the things also, when you see, if you have any kind of web application or logging for when things connect in any way, and you see especially posts and stuff coming from, you know, the user agent is curl. So when you have like those like wgets or curls, there's user agents associated. And a lot of times we look at it going outbound, right? But sometimes inbound stuff might be worth noting, right? Like, what is it that's trying to be passed? Even if it's something that doesn't affect you, it might kind of, from an intelligence perspective, understand kind of what's out there in the wild and what people are trying to do. It's just good. It's a good exercise to go through when you have the time just to see. And then, you know, I've talked about it, you know, that script interpreter chaining. I think it's interesting that the vulnerability allows you to run OS commands. I don't know why PowerShell by itself wouldn't be considered an OS command. So you wouldn't just basically say PowerShell and do the encoded command. They actually started with command prompt to then run PowerShell. And we've talked about that, you know, exhaustively about how just those types of behaviors are sometimes just suspicious because a person usually doesn't try to do it that way. And you called out some key things in the, and their decoding of the PowerShell. But one of the things I always find interesting as well is a lot of times, especially from PowerShell, it's not common for PowerShell to try to reconstruct things at the byte level. So if you have PowerShell-based logging, because that's where you'd end up kind of seeing this, especially if it's, you know, an encoded command for one, but if it's not directly in line and it's kind of from a script or some sort of PowerShell payload, you'd have to have that transcript and that PowerShell logging enabled, but you'd be able to see things like the new object and then byte, right? Meaning that it's basically trying to create a new object, but it's going to be based on bytes being passed to it. And then you've got, the dot read, with some arguments, passed to it, and the dot write associated to some of the same things. Those I think are telling when there's something being written that is like a non-standard way to create something. Not saying every instance of that is bad. I just find that to be more abnormal and something that if you are looking for these, it shouldn't pop up that often. And if it does, it's worth taking a look of like, what is it trying to fetch or create, in that way. So that was interesting. Also, when I saw the argument list, I quickly tried to cyber chef it to see, cause it looked like just base64 encoded, but it's more than that. When I try to do some of the basic cyber chef stuff, and then ran magic through it as well. And it's some sort of encoding, maybe even a level of encryption mixed in. I'm not sure. But I'm really curious that, you know, when they say a long argument list, it really is just an encoded blob of something. So yeah, all pretty interesting though.
What do you got next for us?
So the next one I'm going to start with is kind of a newsworthy item that's kind of hit. And it's interesting, right? And I just sourcing directly from Notepad++. So they have a blog talking about the recent security incident or whatever you want to call it, associated with them. And basically, they had discovered an incident beginning roughly in June 2025. And I think they were able to confidently say December 2nd that all the hardening, all the things they needed to do to say that everything was safe. So from June to December, they actively had this problem. And it was interesting how it kind of popped up, because there were some instances where people were complaining about potential compromises. And one of the things noticed was Notepad++ was a consistent theme across these different incidents that also were not even within the same organization. And I mean, looking at the target set alone, and this is what's kind of interesting when you talk about attribution, they're all targets that were, I guess, more aligned with what China state sponsored groups typically target. So there's kind of a thread to kind of run on there, but with no definitive proof. And what ended up happening is they discovered, and they're still trying to figure out exactly how this happened, but, you know, obviously a lot of these services, they're going to be using a hosting provider, just like anywhere you host a website, anywhere you host any of your, you know, publicly facing stuff. And somehow the hosting provider was able to be manipulated in a way to when people were going to fetch the Notepad++ update. And it sounded like it wasn't everybody that was fetching it. It was basically people that were selected by this actor would get a malicious payload, right? That would then install basically a backdoor to their system. And Rapid7 did kind of a write up on it. And they call it Chrysalis backdoor, right? And you know, the big key thing here that is noteworthy is from a lot of their techniques. The initial, I guess it's common for the China state sponsors group to use this dropper called an NSYS installer, which is just commonly used. But when it drops its installer, it actually drops a DLL, which is the malicious DLL they're trying to install. And in this case, they dropped a Bluetooth service.exe, which really is a renamed exe, which is Bitdefender Submission Wizard. That's vulnerable to this. So they use DLL sideloading in order to basically execute that stuff. So that's like the biggest key thing to focus on there. They drop this in a hidden directory, or they make the directory hidden. And I was looking to see, you know, there's a multitude of ways to actually hide a directory depending on how you call it. And my guess is that's probably built into their dropper tool. So I couldn't see any telemetry that kind of focus on hiding something specifically. But the key piece here was identifying that DLL sideloading and that typical EXE and DLL being created and dropped. And in this case, I wonder if they, I know they mentioned, they're in the app data folder, right? And they created a directory that was hidden called Bluetooth. So being able to, I think what would be interesting is if you are collecting telemetry for EXE and DLL writes in general, you'll see things written to app data, which is a common place where things get dropped. And kind of, so those three things combined are pretty telling. But since then, obviously, Notepad++ has, you know, fixed the issue. And one of the ways they fixed it is they no longer are using, I think they had a self-signed cert as far as their installer package. And now it's actually officially signed package for their updater, which helps remediate things like this, where it's like that supply chain issue. That's why certs are so important. And not everyone signs something by an approved CA, especially for code. There's a lot of self-signing if it is signed. But it is a good indicator to know what things you have as well, because a lot of telemetry and a lot of tools will tell you if something is signed and by who. Sometimes it's good to know how things are signed in your environment, so you can scrutinize things in the future if you needed to, or could help potentially help with investigations or net new things that show up as weird signatures. So It's an interesting story when it comes to supply chain. Because I mean, Notepad plus plus, you don't really think, I know there's been some things in the past where they're kind of patching different things, with it, but there are a lot of people who use Notepad plus plus. A lot of people that use Notepad plus plus sometimes are the more technical IT folks. So there might be, great targets, especially if you're trying to get, you know, potentially more access or information, to go after people that use it. So, yeah, those are like the key insights. I know people were talking about it, but like I said, the DLSI loading piece, which is a very common technique, it's very effective, but it's also, if you have, or you're tracking the right telemetry, which Sysmon, if you don't have the telemetry, best source to get the telemetry, because you can just set up just for file creates for DLLs and EXEs, which doesn't happen that often. So it shouldn't really create a huge bump in your collection strategy. Worth noting. So yeah, I don't know what your thoughts were when you were seeing this pop up across the news headlines.
Well, then my initial thing was, and I want to be completely honest here. This one stressed me a little bit, just thinking about the potential fallout. I was just like, ah, man, and then the way it was done, it was pretty interesting. And the time gaps kind of rubbed me the wrong way, the fact that this was kind of a thing from last year, how widely, plus plus is used, and just, thinking about like what would be the scale of the fallout. But moving from that, into the articles, there was one thing that I was generally curious about, and this one moved over to that Rapid7 article, Scott, where they actually talk about the different commands and flags that are within the response and command processing. So they talked about two specifics. However, I don't see that anywhere else other than here. With one of the flags, it's like a four --, but it basically talks about by running this flag, it'll delete auxiliary payload files, remove persistence artifacts from both the Windows service registry hive and the run key, and then it generates and executes a temporary bash file, which, here we go again, single character executable to delete the running executable after termination, and then it removes that whole bash script itself. So there was a little thing that I picked up, and I was kind of curious. When you see stuff like this that talks about what they've identified that a given piece will do, but you don't see it, because I'm sure you've come across articles like this, but you don't see it discussed in all of the other artifacts that they found as they were analyzing this. Do you consider that valuable to hunt for for a given thing for any of the hunters out there? Or do you think that's not information enough to consider, attributing to this specifically?
So, I think that's a great point. And I think, we've already talked about it a little bit, but the next couple of things we're going to cover kind of fall down the same line of this. So typically when I see unique things on different reporting, I pay attention to them, because anyone that reports anything, depending on their purpose, if it's news, sometimes they don't get too technical because they don't want to bore their audience and they want more readers, right? Make it simple. If it's a security firm, sometimes they want to be technical, but they want to give away everything they've learned, because then they lose their advantage as a provider. So you kind of get bits and pieces, and typically how I might address some of those things, is, are the bits and pieces easy to operationalize? If they are, it's worth doing, right? If you see something that's really unique and you're like, oh man, that looks like a really good fingerprint, but man, how do I do that? Maybe I put it on the back burner, right? Or take notes or see what else I can do that would help. But if I think I have enough everywhere else, it's more about prioritizing work at that point. Right. And if it's something that you are deathly concerned about, this is somebody that it's affected so many people, we need to be 100% positive, and we know we are a likely target because we meet all the criteria, then you kind of just do it all because you have to, right? Because you want to. So it's really just a decision-making process there. But I think you're absolutely right. When you come across stuff like that, you kind of have to have what is your approach for that? How do you want to handle that? And be able to make those decisions easily by almost a process perspective. Because I'm even looking here, I didn't dig into some of the tail end of that Rapid7, but they talk about some of the unique things too, where they even talk about having a CMD EXE reverse shell. So they're going to have CMD running and using redirected pipes to try to create that reverse shell, which is interesting behavior. You mentioned the U.bat, but they also talk about registry run keys as potential persistence with this payload. So there are some common themes even within the payload that gets dropped from this whole thing that doesn't show you exactly how it's done, right? So you might have to theorize or do additional research, but they're worth noting that, hey, this is a payload that, you know, if it has its capabilities, there's probably other things out there that might share something similar. So it might be behavior worth putting on the list. Just when you address it is when you address it.
No, it makes sense.
Yeah. So like I kind of hinted before, but I'll kind of do, well, sorry, it's your turn. You go ahead and then I'll do my rundown of mine.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're going to kind of cross over on this one, but specifically for a point. So I'll let you kind of spin home that point as we move into your second article, but I'm going to kick it off with this one. So I have an article from Zscaler titled APT28 Leverages CVE 2026-21509 Operation Noosploit, if I'm saying that correctly, or Noosploit. So Zscaler's research details Operation Noosploit, an advanced intrusion campaign by APT28. You might also know them as Fancy Bear or Strontium. They weaponized a previously patched Microsoft vulnerability. That's that CVE 2026-21509 to gain initial access and execute follow-on malicious activity. APT28 has repeatedly demonstrated selective targeting of government and military sectors, and this campaign continued that pattern with tailored exploitation aimed at high-value information theft and lateral movement. The operation showcases how modern APT groups combine zero-day or recent patch exploits with custom tooling and one of the ones we scream about all the time, living off the land binaries and living off the land techniques to reduce innovative detection. By weaponizing a newer vulnerability before widespread exploitation was publicly acknowledged, APT28 underscores that importance of maybe considering a rapid patch adoption or really looking at what your telemetry analysis can provide. So some of the details and highlights in this, the CVE is a critical issue in a Microsoft component that allows attackers to achieve remote code execution on vulnerable hosts with crafted input and Noosploit. APT28 leveraged this flaw to drop and execute initial access payloads on network exposed systems. Exploitation was observed via HTTP, HTTPS requests with malformed input leading to server compromise, allowing for the execution of shell payloads and process creation. So after exploiting the CVE, the actor deployed a custom DLL loader and invoked native Windows utilities to sideload malicious DLLs into trusted system processes. APT28 used Red Server 32 and Run DLL 32 to load malicious modules into memory, a known, living off the land pattern that leverages signed binaries to evade your security controls. Post-exploitation, the group established C2 connections using customized network channels that blended with normal web traffic, reducing that detection noise. And persistence was achieved through modified registry run key, scheduled tasks, and again, malicious DLL sideloading of legitimate service hosts. The toolkit observed includes credential harvesting modules that dump LSAS memory and extract the NTLM hashes, followed by pass the hash NTLM relay activity to try to move laterally. APT28 also used WMI and remote PowerShell to execute commands on downstream hosts without direct interactive logons, enhancing their stealth. And then custom loaders were used that delayed execution and obfuscation to hide code segments and impede that static detection. And then there's binary components were observed wrapped in simple packers, and network beacons were throttled to really avoid those your kind of common IDS, IPS type triggers. So something to note, there were in the article, there's two breakouts. So they discuss a variant one and a variant two. So I'm just going to kind of give some quick bullets on that to kind of set the stage as we kind of roll into yours, Scott. So variant one, it targets Windows environments with crafted network offflows, exploits legacy NTLM behavior to coerce outbound authentication attempts. It captures those NTLM V1 hashes and NTLM hashes, for credential replay, offline cracking, lateral movement, and so on. Emphasizes stealthy access validation rather than immediate payload delivery, and aligns with APT28's historical focus on credential harvesting over malware noise. So the variant two kind of points more towards the post-exploitation and payload enablement it builds and stacks on the validated access from variant one, but it leverages malicious infrastructure endpoints to retrieve additional content, uses a lightweight HTTP GET request, including adding operating system specific paths to help with staging. The payload delivery and execution is environment aware, so it's very much Windows focused, it seems. And the activity suggests a second stage enablement for persistence, espionage tooling, lateral movement prep, and so on. So, you know, there's a bunch with this, Scott, and I don't want to dive too much in the Hunt stuff yet. I'm going to do something a little non-traditional for our show. I'm going to kick it over to you, let you dive into your article, and then maybe we can summarize it all together as we go.
Yeah, so a little backstory on why I'm going to jump into mine before we kind of dive even deeper is, you know, sometimes when Tom and I are looking for things to talk about, it happens, not often, but it does happen where we come across similar sources. And in this case, the thing that I kind of came across, and I always think it's a great resource. So, you know, we're talking about APT28, right? Well, one of the best sources, I think, from a cyber perspective of how Russia APTs operate is really paying attention to the UA CERT, right? Ukrainian CERT, or CERT UA, I guess is how they do it. It's their computer emergency response team of Ukraine, right? They do a lot of reporting. Oddly enough, right, it's going to be written not in English. So a lot of times you do have to translate. Everything translates fine with most browsers and translation functions. But what was interesting here is, you know, they're reporting on the same CVE that was kind of needed to be patched out of band because the vulnerability is actively being exploited. And they only really covered really the second variant component. They added some additional details. So I think the one interesting detail that they definitely covered was it was kind of mentioned in your Zscaler article, and it's mentioned kind of in the hash of the file, but they make a mention. So like, oh yeah, they use Phylon cloud storage. Well, something when we talk about behaviors and you talk about Russian state sponsored, you know, they're known for using Dropbox, using Discord, using these kind of open providers for different things. And in this case, Phylon, which isn't honestly a cloud storage I'm familiar with. I don't know if it's more popular different regions, right? But they did a huge call out towards, hey, really pay attention to any type of network telemetry going to any of the file and cloud storage infrastructure. And they list IPs, they list domains, things to pay attention to, which I thought was really good. The other thing to take note, which I'll get into a little bit, is we've talked about COM objects before. And to try to simplify this as best as possible is, COM objects is kind of the way to enable inter-process communication, right? And one of the methods when they get in and are able to kind of run the things they want to run, they use COM object hijacking, which essentially says, okay, they're going to replace what destinations or defined destinations in the nproc server 32, which is under the registry key infrastructure for the current user software classes CLS ID. And then user is like a GUID, and that GUID usually corresponds to an application or service. And the nproc server 32 will typically have criteria about how that works. And in this case, the malicious DLL that they leverage gets dropped in there, and they do also drop criteria for how it should run, which is a threading model, which in this case they define as apartment. Only thing to really know about that is apartment basically is like it's a single thread operation. It doesn't need to have multi-threading or any kind of thing. It can do everything within a single thread, doesn't need to lock resources to be able to operate because it's doing multiple things. It's just easier to honestly create, I think, code. If it's single threaded, you know, less complexity. So they just kind of define it that way because it's probably written that way. And in this case, what's interesting in the follow on activities is in order for sometimes a COM object to be enabled or injected, whatever is associated with it needs to be restarted. And in this case, it's tied to explorer.exe. I haven't done the research to see exactly how that COM object's directly in link with that, but they create a scheduled task, right, that will then run a command to kill Explorer, restart Explorer, which would then enable that COM object and then basically delete that scheduled task, which I think is an interesting, you know, chain of events when you know they exist. You know, that's important to note. But anytime you have Improc Server 32 values changing and things being loaded in that are executables, DLLs, things like that, I think they typically are DLLs. It's worth noting. Sometimes that could create a lot of noise because there's other things within those registry directories that do change for tracking things. But if you can put criteria on what the values are, that might help reduce a lot of the noise and things you might collect or learn. But that was one of the key pieces they were looking at from the UA cert piece. And they focused on, and they also got in, I mean, they provided a lot of the network telemetry. And what was interesting here is there were a lot of SMB calls, not just HTTP references. Obviously, they're using WebDAV. That's kind of like the exploit they're kind of taking advantage of, is where they're able to call things in via WebDAV. The one thing that's unique is they mention, and I don't know if this is just because they didn't include everything, and I don't know if you saw this in your article, Tom, but they mentioned the name of a few different of the dot docs that are being passed, right? And then when I looked at the network traffic, a lot of the SMB callouts were to Blink dot doc for a lot of them, right? I want to say they had like four different callouts to Blink doc. And then I know they mentioned that they use .lmks for as some examples for things that were downloaded from, and this is from the HTTP side, where they had document.doc.lmk being mentioned for some of their downloads. So unique, like it seemed like very benign names, but then when you actually look what were being passed or to the attacks they mentioned on the 26th of January, there were like consultation topics Ukraine dot doc. So it seemed like more official naming. So I don't know if there's just a disconnect there or what, but I don't know if I didn't dig into yours so much to see that specifically.
Yeah, I didn't have in the one that I was going through, definitely didn't have anything with the Blink dot docs at all. They do talk about some of the ones that were dropped, some of those file indicators. You mentioned the consultation topics, Ukraine. There's also one, courses.doc, and then an arbitrary one, arbitrarily named one that just was four digits. So it's 1291 in this specific one, which was the, that doc was specifically set for exploiting that CVE, but yeah, didn't have the blank ones. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know if I made the tie, but something that to be known is, so the Covenant is what's dubbed the software tool that's being dropped by APT28 in this reference. And that whole file and cloud infrastructure piece, that's what they directly tie to that software. Like historically, they've been using that for Covenant, and apparently currently they're still using that. So that's why, especially when there's like common infrastructure looking like that, it's good to pay attention to. And what's really great, like let's say, you know, the future of this Covenant tool that's being leveraged, they have to switch up some of their infrastructure. Well, if you have enough telemetry or insight into what that looks like and how they're using even the file and cloud storage, like at their specific calls that are obvious, whatever, there might be patterns in there that you might be able to extract. So if something else is being leveraged, you can see the same patterns. Those are really a gold mine, but sometimes it's really hard unless someone shares it or you actively were affected by it to pull those things out. So it's, you know, it's things that the benefits of being hit, I guess you can get a huge advantage moving forward, but you might already be in a bad place, right? That I thought was pretty cool. But yeah, I think the important thing here is really, when you find sourcing on stuff, especially if it's a big newsworthy item, a big attack, or someone you're really interested in, or something that's novel, like try to really find more sources and search on the behaviors you're finding, search on, you know, some key name things, however you can try to group things together, because you can come across a lot of different things. I don't know if you mentioned it too, but the forward email rules that were put in place from the first variant, something else is a good thing to call out if you have visibility to any kind of Outlook forwarding email. a lot of times there's controls to protect against that, but you know, worth paying attention to as well.
Yeah, good points. All good points. And I can't help but echo what you had said about you know, kind of multi-sourcing based on what you're trying to do. If you can, definitely do it. There's a lot of really good researchers out there. You know, compare and contrast their notes to make you the most effective, right?
Yeah, and I don't think I mentioned it before, but this was something that was, you know, that I kind of had an out-of-band patch for, but there are, if you go to the vulnerability on Microsoft site, and the vulnerability is the CVE-2026-21509, they do provide some mitigation things that you can put in, and they're just registry key creates. So, you know, if you are affected by this and you're running older Office in your infrastructure or what have you, they have all the information there that can tell you how to kind of resolve some of this or make you less vulnerable to this. Definitely worth checking out as well. But yeah, like it's, I don't know, these kind of attacks I think are kind of fun to see. I'm sure it's not fun when you're in the midst of it, but I like how there's like these multi-stage and different angles. So
yeah, it's personal preference, man. If I as a practitioner, I find it the most enjoyable going after the stuff that's APT based because of the complexity, all the varied pieces of it, the way that they ebb and flow and adjust and how quickly it happens. It's just, it's really cool, you know?
And it's different from your typical ransomware. Like you can easily see when you're studying this stuff, the clear delineation. And it's not that they're, you know, ransomware groups aren't effective. They are, but the approach is,
their goals are pretty straightforward, right?
Right. Yeah. They're not looking to try to, like, you know, do something innovative. They're looking to just basically get in and get out, you know? Yeah. So, with that, there's only really one big announcement that I want to make so people are aware. There is another threat hunting workshop that'll be February 11th. It's Hunting for Privilege Escalation Level 2. That'll be from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, still with our, you know, our famous Lee Arcanol. These are really good hands-on, get to see data, get to, you know, repeat the process. I think you can even earn the badge based on going through some of the stuff and hunting for some of the things. So definitely worth checking out if you want to get your hands dirty and play with some things. And so with that, I think that kind of concludes everything for this week. I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 2nd, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.